You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with a UW professor who led a three-year grass study using different lawn care approaches on sports fields out of Stoughton Park.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. For the first time, we've got poll numbers measuring how Wisconsinites feel about Foxconn coming to Wisconsin and the state's decision to offer a $3 billion incentive package to attract that company.
We'll also talk about a Wisconsin county's decision to move forward with a lawsuit against drug companies and the latest efforts to improve staff safety at Lincoln Hills, Wisconsin's troubled youth prison.
Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and he's with us almost every Friday to look back at the week's biggest news. Hey, Rob.
Hey.
So we've got some new Foxconn data. We've been covering this as it unfolded here on Central Time. And now a new Marquette University Law School poll dropped earlier this week, taking a look at how people in the Milwaukee region are feeling about Foxconn. What did it find?
Right. Short version would be it found a more mixed picture than one might have predicted. I mean, we've talked many times about the substance of the deal, the possible economic impact, and the nature of the state's $3 billion incentive package. So this is really just about the public's perception of this. This comes from the Marquette University Law School. It's a good poll, and it's worth taking a look at. They looked at in southeastern Wisconsin. So in Milwaukee County, Waukesha, Racine, just right in that area that would be, you know, that would seem to be most likely to be affected by Foxconn, they found that 54% of those surveys say that the Foxconn factory will substantially improve the economy in the area. 37% say it won't. So that is a majority saying that it will improve the economy, but that's also a significant bit on the negative side. But the other piece of this is 48% of the respondents say that they do not believe the state will recoup the $3 billion in incentives that it's offering Foxconn. Only 38% said that they think it will be a good deal for the state.
So mixed feelings on that. Any surprises in there for you, Rob?
Well, I mean, I think it's key to remember that this is the Milwaukee Racine area. There were another piece of the poll is 65% of those polled said that they don't believe that they or their families will benefit from the plan. I don't know. It is a guess. I don't have data, but one would assume that people would be most bullish on the plan in this exact region. So one wonders what somebody in the northern part of the state or Fox Valley or elsewhere will see this.
And meanwhile, there was some other Foxconn-ish news. Wisconsin's Job Creation Agency delayed a vote on the final Foxconn contract because of a problem that one Democratic senator called a nuclear bomb for taxpayers. It's a pretty loaded phrase. What do we know about that?
Right. It's guaranteeing. There are some guarantees that the that Foxconn has to pay back some of these incentives. It's common in these sorts of deals that a lot of there are incentives can be tied to specific job creation goals or other outcomes as a result of the project. There is still a lot that's a bit mysterious about exactly the nature of what caused this delay, but it seems like the wording did not include those guarantees.
Talking to Rob Menser right now from USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, catching up on the biggest stories this week in Wisconsin news. And moving on now, another Wisconsin county took steps this week to join a legal challenge against several pharmaceutical companies. And this is over the opioid crisis. And this is interesting timing. The decision comes during the same week that President Trump declared the nation's opioid crisis a public health emergency. And this is Sheboygan County that we're looking at. What are they choosing to do?
Sure. Sheboygan County has joined up on what a group of three Wisconsin law firms are trying to make a true statewide effort to file lawsuits, sue these big pharma companies, large pharmaceutical companies that that produced and notably for the purposes of the lawsuit, marketed opiate painkillers in a way that they will argue was misleading, and that led to a lot of the opiate epidemic that we're seeing in Wisconsin and across the country now. It is objectively the case that a lot of today's heroin addicts began their addiction in some form of prescription pills, and so this lawsuit would be an attempt to, you know, hold the makers of those drugs responsible for costs to law enforcement and child safety services and other services that are shouldered by counties.
And Sheboygan County is one of several counties that are looked to be choosing to pursue this. There's not consensus in Sheboygan County on it. It's controversial, but is this a growing movement in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's fair. It's fair to say that it is. It is the nature of the way that the lawsuit is structured. It doesn't cost money for counties to join it. This is the law firms that are doing this are assuming that they're costs will be paid in the event of a future settlement. So that's a bit appealing if you're a local politician. But yes, so Sheboygan County signed on this week. Last week it was Marathon County. Others on the lawsuit so far are Wood County and Eau Claire County and several others. The law firms involved say that they're going to seek participation from some 60 counties in the state.
So that one, we'll be keeping an eye on that one in the months to come. And Rob, looking at another story, we've also been tracking the latest from the state's troubled youth prison, Lincoln Hills, a situation there with five prison workers going to the hospital over the week after a pair of incidents there. Can you tell us what happened and what's happened since?
Yeah, so two incidents happened over the weekend that sent these workers to prison. There were, this is part of what appear to be deteriorating or certainly are disturbing conditions in the juvenile prison.
They went to the hospital, right?
Right. So ranging from minor injuries to inhalation of pepper spray that caused breathing troubles. So no one is, in grave danger as a result of this. But, I mean, this is multiple workers being taken to the hospital after fights inside this this juvenile facility. It's not a good sign. One staff member called it chaos in an interview with Patrick Marley at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And there was a teacher there who apparently was knocked unconscious and reached out to Governor Walker and had some ideas about how to improve things. It sounds as though the governor has been advised not to talk with her. What do we know about that?
This happened about a week and a half before the incidents on Sunday. A longtime teacher who was there in the classroom. There were no guards or corrections workers, and a student got out of control, punched her, and knocked her out, put her in the hospital, and she has been public about her story. She shared a photo of her black eye and spoke about her experience. The dynamic in Lincoln Hills School, I'm an outsider to this. I haven't done my own reporting. I've talked to a couple of people who have worked there. And there is as an outsider, it appears that there's sort of a vicious cycle. The place is objectively understaffed, and that's multiple studies have found that. That makes the workers feel unsafe, which in turn makes them rely on these very harsh disciplinary measures. So they maintain control by using pepper spray or handcuffs or solitary confinement. Those practices in turn led to a set of a lawsuit by the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin, the Juvenile Law Center, and Lincoln Hills has been ordered to reduce its use of pepper spray. That in turn makes the workers feel less safe. And it's hard to know what to do, but the dynamic is very destructive.
And Rob, as we wrap up, a lighter story here. Well, not if you love Aaron Rodgers, but Aaron Rodgers, as we know, out of commission, Wisconsin's favorite athlete. But as I understand it, good news for sports fans who have that Aaron Rodgers-sized hole in their hearts. There's someone new who's in the running for state's favorite athlete. And this is a Milwaukee Bucks player that I gather is affectionately known as the Greek Freak. Can you tell us about him?
The Greek Freak, Giannis Antetokounmpo. Veronica, the football season's over. We both know it. Let's just own up to it. It's basketball season now. This is where I advise all Wisconsinites to turn their attention. Giannis Antetokounmpo is off to an incredibly hot start with the Bucks, and I think Bucks fans have sort of already knew that he was very good at playing basketball, but he's gotten a bunch of new attention from the national sports media. He is the subject of a cover feature by ESPN, the magazine, and other outlets have written about him. He could be the next LeBron James. It's not far-fetched. He's 22 years old, and he's averaging like 37 points per game, I think, so far this year.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I have to keep an eye on him. And Rob, I want to say thank you. This is the last time we're going to talk. My last day on the show is Wednesday, so this is our last news roundup, but it's been great talking with you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Good luck to you, Veronica.
Thanks a lot, Rob. That was Rob Menser from USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He's with us almost every Friday to look back at the week's biggest news. First, have you ever wondered why your neighbor's lawn is so green, weed-free, and wonderfully squishy to walk on? Well, our next guest might be able to help with that. He just completed a 3-year experiment where he used several different approaches to lawn maintenance using sports fields in Stoughton as a testing ground.
Doug Soldat joins us now. He's a professor and UW Extension Specialist with the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. Doug, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Glad to be here, Rob.
Well, let's talk about what's at stake here. A lot of kids, mine included, and grown-ups too, for that matter, rely on these sports fields around the state, and these things have to be able to put up with some serious abuse.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm going to a soccer game and 3 flag football games tomorrow.
Okay.
So, yeah, they do. They take a lot of traffic. They take a lot of wear. And it's hard to manage them and keep them in good shape.
Now, you tried to do some serious science here, 4 different approaches, and it was on baseball fields, right, in Stoughton?
Yeah, we used Racetrack Park, which is baseball and softball, but they also play flag football in the outfield and probably some soccer. So it's multi-use fields, yep.
And what defines good turf on a field? A lot goes into it.
Yeah, you need it to be functional. So a lot of people think, well, we shouldn't use inputs on turf because we just use it to make it look pretty. But really with
inputs
with
like fertilizer,
irrigation, and weed control products. But really we do a lot of those in sports fields to maintain the turf, to make it a safe playing surface for the kids and athletes.
And people want it to look good.
Yep, and there's always that. That's the first thing we think of. But there's also a lot of function to a nice sports field.
And Stoughton was on board. They wanted to get to the bottom of this, and they were willing to put their fields into play here.
Yeah, Stoughton was really cool to work with because they had some questions about like what's the best environmental way to do this, right? We want to use inputs in the most responsible way, and so we thought this is a great opportunity to demonstrate the kind of the range of options that are available to people to produce a functional surface. So we had an organic system. We had the city of Stoughton's traditional system, how they normally do things. And then we had what we call an integrated turf grass management program, which is kind of like a hybrid of the two.
And then there was a control field where you did
Did nothing on the control, right? And so just to show that if you don't manage turf, if you stop all inputs, what happens to the field and how the field changes over those 2 or 3 years.
So these are 4 separate fields, 4 separate ways of doing them. How long did you do this?
This was the end of our 3rd season. So 2015, 2016, and 2017 all had the treatments implemented. And at this point, the differences are fairly large. The control field, which hasn't been managed, is ready to be managed. So we're going to turn it back over to the city of Stoughton.
Yeah, let's take these fields one at a time. I'm curious to hear how they all worked out. And let's do the let's start with the do nothing approach to a baseball diamond. Doesn't look like it's the way to go.
No, definitely not the way to go. Unfortunately, a lot of lawns and sports fields use that do-nothing approach, so it's estimated that 50% of the lawns in the U.S. just receive mowing. Now, with lawns, they don't get as much traffic, so they can tolerate that. It's not as bad as sports fields. If you're not putting fertilizer at a minimum on a sports field, the turf grass thins, weeds come in, and what you're left with is a lot of bare ground, and that's really hard. You get a hard surface, and hard surfaces aren't good for people to be playing on.
So are people playing on these fields as this experiment's going on? Are these actively in use?
They're actively in use, absolutely. So when we had a public meeting with the city and anybody who wanted to come out a few days ago, and there were flag football practices going on the fields.
And so what does that look like when they're out there playing baseball or flag football? And what, you've got bear patches, I imagine?
Well, yeah. When we started in 2015, the field that we haven't managed for 3 years, just mowing, was in really good shape. And so the starting point was good. So it's taken 3 years to the point where now we feel like it's time to get it back in better shape. So now, bare patches, lots of weeds, thin turf after 3 years.
We're managing our sports fields in Wisconsin here with Doug Soldot, professor and UW Extension Specialist with the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, talking about an ongoing experiment in Stoughton using different ways to take care of turf on sports fields. Okay, that was the do-nothing approach. Sounds like that's not working.
Mm-hmm.
So compare and contrast how much inputs, fertilizer and other products, are going into the other three, the organic, the integrated system, and then what Stoughton had been doing.
Sure. So we wanted to, for the three that we used, we wanted to make sure that they were realistic to match with Stoughton's budget. And a city like Stoughton, like any city, modest resources, mm-hmm. lots of fields to take care of, and they typically only make one application a year of fertilizer and pest control products. And so that's what we tried to do. So we, we put down about a pound and a half of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet is the technical term, but that's about half as much nitrogen as a well-maintained lawn would receive. So it's the inputs we used were relatively on the low end, but that was to match up with Stoughton's resources.
So the organic one, what is that? What went into that, and how did it come out?
So organic did pretty well because one of the best things that you can do is keep your turf thick, and to do that, you use fertilizer. There's all kinds of really effective organic fertilizers in Wisconsin and on the market, and we used two different ones over the course of the study, and we were able to keep the turf density reasonably thick. Now, the problem with organic is we don't have a lot of really good weed control options. There's a handful out there, but the ones we have are marginally effective and very expensive. So we didn't use any organic weed control over the three-year study. So we are seeing weeds coming in, But the organic fertilizer kept that field really thick and looking pretty good.
And then there's the what Stoughton usually does, and then the integrated approach. How does that compare in terms of the amount of fertilizer and herbicides that you use?
Right. So the amount of fertilizer we used in all three fields was about the same.
Okay.
Yep. Approximately the same. Now the integrated or the Stoughton City approach would use traditional herbicides to control the weeds, and they'd use nitrogen fertilizers that were relatively quick release all their nitrogen after they were applied. The UW integrated approach used herbicides that were had lower pesticide hazard scores, but they were still what we would consider conventional pesticides.
All right, side by side, how did those two do?
The best looking turf right now would be the City of Stoughton's plan. It was the least expensive, which is also nice, but it was also it also had higher environmental impact scores. So the UW plan had a little bit higher cost. Turf grass quality was slightly reduced, a few more weeds, but we were able to do it in what we think is a more environmentally friendly way.
So now, what does a city like Stoughton or anywhere start to do with this information? It's not a clear slam dunk in one direction or another. How can they take this information and start to make decisions?
Yeah, so the, you know, it's a democratic process. They can meet with the stakeholders and get input on ways forward. We did an economic analysis. They've seen the fields now, and they can produce they can duplicate one of the treatments exactly, or they can integrate different elements of it. So I think it was good to show that there's a range of options that can be chosen to meet the needs of all the stakeholders.
Do you get calls from a lot of communities around the state who obviously have a strong interest in how best to manage their fields?
Yeah, we do. We do get a lot of inquiries, and generally we do most of our research at the OJ Nora Turfgrass Research Facility in Verona. We invite people out there to see what we're doing and share our results that way. This was a really nice, unique opportunity where we actually got to do our work in the community itself.
Live testing in the
field.
Yeah,
it's always fun.
So this was season three. Is this still going to go on now?
I think we learned what we wanted to learn. The control field needs to be managed. I think we're going to turn it over to City of Stoughton and let them take it from here.
And are you looking for a new guinea pig now?
we're always interested in new guinea pigs and trying to learn new things, and especially get out in the community and reach people.
And very briefly, any lessons here from a homeowner who may not have all the cleats running across it, but still wants to take some lessons?
Yeah, one of the things I'm always amazed by is one of the best ways to keep weeds out is to maintain turf density with one or two fertilizer applications a year.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Doug Soldot. He's a professor and UW Extension Specialist with the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. We've been talking about his recent experiment, 3 years long, studying different approaches to lawn maintenance at Stoughton Athletic Fields. Now, in the past month, two prominent Republican senators announced they won't seek re-election. The move leaves their seats potentially vulnerable to competition from Democrats.
And their future departure could spell trouble for the party as it grapples with infighting and a loss of confidence.
And this all comes at a time when a recent poll conducted by the Pew Research Center found that Republicans and Republican-leaning independents are less confident in the future of the party. This could all potentially spell trouble for the GOP going forward.
Lily Gorin is with us now. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Her published books include Women in the White House and Mad Men in Politics. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
Well, let's start with these announced departures of Republican Senators Bob Corker of Tennessee and Jeff Flake of Arizona. If we're reading the tea leaves here, what do you think these departures could mean?
Well, I mean, you have to also possibly throw into that mix the likelihood that John McCain, also of Arizona, will probably not run for re-election, but he was recently re-elected, so he's in the Senate for a while. But what you are seeing with regard to Corker and Flake, and to a degree McCain, are some high-profile Republican, long-standing Republicans in elected office who are choosing to leave. And in the case of Flake and Corker, they were getting some pretty serious challenges in primaries in their states, ones that they may not have been able to weather. And some of the sort of track record for some of these sort of more traditional, I don't know that they're really moderate, but establishment conservatives like Eric Cantor and Richard Lugar from Indiana, and who were challenged in primaries and lost. And so what you have is a possible, you know, sort of situation where a number of these Republicans who are also not necessarily on board at this point with the Trump administration. And what's interesting with regard to Corker was that he was an early and fairly consistent supporter of candidate Trump. But he has become really dissatisfied with the Trump administration and seemingly also with the president himself, particularly in regard to foreign policy. And Corker is the chair of the Senate Foreign Policy Committee.
And I'm wondering how you think these Republicans who are not running again are viewed both by their fellow legislators and by the public. Are these Republicans who have the courage to speak their conscience, or are they politicians afraid of facing a challenger picked by Steve Bannon?
Well, I mean, certainly some people are suggesting that they are afraid of facing challengers in situations where, in Flake's case, apparently polling was very much indicating that he was going to have a significant challenge. and he was likely, although, you know, it's hard to predict, would lose in the primary. But Flake had also published a book this summer that was pretty much critical of Trump. So he's been fairly consistent. And so in the case of these, the Republican senators, and again, they're pretty high profile. They have been able to and have long had a lot of attention focused on them. And they've been combative with the president from their party. And that's, you know, again, something that when you have majority control by one party in the House, in the Senate, in the White House, it should be an opportunity for a lot of legislation to come through that everybody is in agreement on, and to move a sort of president's agenda forward. And what we've seen over the last, you know, 8 months since the inauguration, but even possibly before then, since Trump's election, is that there isn't necessarily a Trump unifying the Republican Party. And on some level, it looks to observers and academics that Trump and the Republican Party, or parts of the Republican Party, are very antagonistic, and that there's, to some degree, maybe not warfare, but really quite a lot of tension within the party that has majority control, you know, in two of the three branches of government.
And you can hear some of that tension in what Senator Flake said when he announced that he wouldn't seek re-election. Here he is on the Senate floor.
We were not made great as a country by indulging in or even exalting our worst impulses, turning against ourselves, glorifying in the things that divide us, and calling fake things true and true things fake. And we did not become the beacon of freedom in the darkest corners of the world by flouting our institutions and failing to understand just how hard won and vulnerable they are.
Almost hearing his voice, I think, shake at the end of that, very emotional and, as I understand, pretty unprecedented. Can you put that into context? How big a deal is a statement like that?
That statement is not the norm. And, you know, I saw something about it in my Twitter feed when it first happened, and I'd been in classes. And then, you know, I sort of said that Jeff Flake wasn't running for re-election. And then I saw something about the speech. And so I went and I watched the speech and didn't read it. And in watching it and listening to him, you're right. His voice is extremely emotional. It's clearly a very heartfelt speech. He ends it, he concludes it with quoting Lincoln's second inaugural, which is again at the end of the Civil War, and asking for, you know, a unity to come into the country after our Civil War. And Flake makes reference to that during the course of the speech. And again, this is a kind of significant and very statesman-like oratory on the floor of the Senate. And again, we have had speeches on the floor of the Senate to this effect, but it's not normal, and it's usually not during times of peace. Also, they're usually more often, you know, sort of oratory of this kind that you hear as we're about to enter into war or have something to do with a war.
We're talking to Lily Gorin right now from Carroll University in Waukesha, and she's with us right now to talk about the future of the Republican Party. And you were talking about how there is a lot of shifting ground within the party right now, a lot of animosity among different factions, it seems like. And so I wonder if you think the Republican Party, is it in the act? Are we watching it splintering from what we think of as the establishment party to something new, maybe something more aligned with populism or what some people are calling Trumpism?
Well, until there's another party that is, you know, Republicans sort of leaving the party itself and starting or moving into another party, I think that what you see is a kind of combat if inside the Republican Party for the direction that it will go, and not only with regard to policy, but also dispositionally. And that's been part of what Flake and Corker and to a degree when he's been critical, Lindsey Graham, senator from South Carolina, and Ann McCain, and even people like Susan Collins, that have been sort of talking dispositionally, that the party, and to a degree also in that regard, the president in particular, and their disposition or their questions about his disposition and his attitude towards the party and the country. And that's been a big, significant part of the critique, because in a lot of ways, a lot of the proposals or potential proposals for policy shifts or agenda changes are ones that many of these Republican senators are supportive of. But it's to some degree giving voice to anti-Semitism or opening the door for anti-Semitism and some of the racism that we've seen in places like Charlottesville, and what the president's leadership or lack thereof have indicated to many of these senators and House members and other elected officials, that's not the Republican Party that they want to be part of.
What kind of role do you think that Steve Bannon has in what we're seeing happen now? Former White House chief strategist, now an executive again at Breitbart News, who has, it seems as though, you know, he's got in his sights Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and that establishment wing of the party. And I wonder what role you see him playing. Do you think it's being overplayed, what his influence is, and where do you think it could go?
Well, I don't know if it's overplayed at this point, because it's hard to know exactly what that influence will be. He has indicated that he would like to have a number of candidates running against people like Jeff Flake. And there was a candidate who was running against Jeff Flake in the primary who was supported by Bannon. But doing that across many different Senate races where you have incumbent senators who are running for re-election, and essentially to have them, quote, primaried. And so Bannon has been recruiting individuals in a variety of states. Apparently, he has been raising funds from some of the big donors to Trump, this Mercer family, among others, and possibly trying to, you know, sort of get to depose, as it were, the Republican, the sitting, quote, establishment Republican in a number of places, and have them replaced by, at least on the Republican side of the ticket, by somebody who is, you know, more in line with Trump dispositionally as well as in terms of policy.
Lily Gorin stays with us. She is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha, and she's with us to talk about the future of the GOP.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see for the future of the Republican Party? Is it Donald Trump's party now, or is it something different than it was 2 years ago? If you voted for President Trump, what are your thoughts on his influence in the party? Do you support efforts to hold primary campaigns against sitting senators who aren't enthusiastic enough about President Trump and his agenda? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll continue our conversation on Central Time in just a bit.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation now about the future of the Republican Party with Lily Gorin. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha.
You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the announcements by Senators Corker and Flake that they are not going to run for re-election, and their criticism in that process of President Trump and his leadership style? What do you see for the future of the Republican Party? Do you think that Republicans should get in line behind a Republican president, or do you worry that President Trump is changing the Republican Party for the worse? You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Lily, House Speaker Paul Ryan recently spoke at a New York dinner, and he pulled some punches with the president there, which isn't terribly surprising given the dinner, but some of the jokes were a little more pointed. Here's a sample.
I want to promise you, though, because I've heard a few stories about how the dinner went last year. So just, I want to put your minds at ease. You can relax about my remarks. I know last year that Donald Trump offended some people. I know his comments, according to critics, went too far. Some said it was unbecoming of a public figure, and they said that his comments were offensive. Well, thank God he's learned his lesson.
Some remarks from Paul Ryan there at the Al Smith dinner in New York. And Lily, what are you hearing that?
Well, you know, the Al Smith dinner is supposed to be an opportunity to poke fun at particularly elected leaders. You know, last year, I believe that Trump was there and Obama, I think, was there. I don't know if Hillary Clinton was there or not, but it is this kind of a roast, if you will. And so Paul Ryan, who isn't known to be a jokester, was, you know, it has also had a kind of I don't want to say tortured, but difficult and sometimes tense relationship with Trump. And so he was, in fact, kind of surfing on some of the general feeling with regard to Trump and Trump's disposition. And, you know, a lot of what Paul Ryan himself have critiqued Trump for, which is, you know, to some degree, his occasionally less than presidential conduct.
I want to take a caller now at 800-642-1234 as we take a look at the shifting ground right now within the Republican Party. We've got Brian with us in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Brian, hi.
Hey, that's a Chicago greeting. Hey.
What do you think, Brian?
Hey, the man won a year ago, so has he done anything that's going to make him unelectable in 3 years? Has he done anything to alienate the people that voted for him in the last election? And I would question whether that could be proved. Of course, California or Illinois, it always is Democratic. You know, they're not going to like him, or Washington State, you know, speaking of impeachment. But as long as he carries Ohio and all the states that he carried the last time, he's going to be president again. You know, and Paul Ryan, he never liked him in the first place.
All right, Brian, thank you for that call. And Brian is looking ahead and wondering about Donald Trump's prospects in the next presidential election. And I guess that's a question. Has the president done anything that would displease his base, the people who got him elected in the first place?
Well, Trump was elected by a little bit more than his base. He was elected by his base, which has been pretty supportive and continues to be very supportive of him. But he was also elected by sort of the Republicans in general, Republicans in Wisconsin, Republicans in Ohio, Republicans in Pennsylvania, Republicans in Tennessee, and so forth. And so the question is, the Republicans who voted for him a year ago, will they all be willing to vote for him again? Because it's unlikely that he has persuaded many people who didn't vote for him to go along with him. Now, that could change over the course of 3 years, obviously, and we are a long way out from 2020. But if you have high-profile Republicans like Corker, who, again, was quite supportive of candidate Trump, sort of saying, you know, I'm not supporting this fellow, and I don't know who Corker will vote for, obviously, and I wouldn't know it in 3 years from now. But that's the kind of part of the election equation that remains kind of amorphous. If you alienate too many of your own people, which Flake and Corker are among, then it's hard to put back together that electoral coalition among the voters.
Right, and how do you see this playing out a little closer than 2020 and 2018 in the midterm elections?
Well, I mean, that again remains to be seen, but you've seen some recent polling with regard to some softness among those Republicans, not necessarily, again, with Trump's loyal base, but among people who voted for him, He was a Republican standard bearer. They're a Republican, and there's been some sort of a little bit of a decrease in the poll numbers with regard to continued both optimism about the Trump administration among those voters and also whether or not they would continue to support him and the Republican Party in 2018. Midterm elections tend to be referenda on the sitting administration. So that means that while the Republicans are structurally at an advantage in terms of the Senate and the Senate races this coming year in 2018, that the, you know, how well the president is doing for his party and within his party can have an impact on the outcomes of those elections.
Well, here's a little glimpse of what we're seeing right now. There's a new study from the Pew Research Center that found that Republicans and Republican-leaning independents are less optimistic about the GOP's future compared with immediately after the election. Less optimism there. And Democrats, it's interesting, their optimism sank pretty quickly after the election, but has popped up a little again. Do those results mean anything to you?
Well, again, we're a long way out, but what's going on now that's interesting, and it's again at lower levels, are, you know, whether incumbents, Republican incumbents, are going to run again. In the case of Corker and Flake, no. So that makes their seats open seats, and so, you know, they're not necessarily going to be won by a Democrat. But if you're running two sort of non-incumbents against each other, then the possibilities are more open than if you're running against an incumbent. How many people have decided in the House and the Senate that they're not going to run again in the Republican, from the Republican Party? How much money are House and Senate members raising, both Democrats and Republicans? And some of the numbers that I've seen is that the Democrats are outraising Republicans for challenging them challenging incumbent Republicans, as well as maintaining their own seats in the House and the Senate. And again, it's a steep climb for the Democrats in terms of holding the Senate seats that are up this year that are Democrats incumbents or taking on challengers, and also to switch the leadership in the House, the majority in the House. But again, that's part of what you're seeing in terms of these kind of optimistic or pessimistic numbers within the voters themselves.
And as we start to wrap up, Lily, just less than a minute left, do you think there's room for reconciliation now? This place that's a little uncomfortable for Republicans, is there room for both the establishment wing and the wing represented by Trump and what he represents to the Republican Party?
I mean, I think there's always opportunities for reconciliation. The, you know, part of the difficulty is if everybody's just angry tweeting all the time, it's harder. and that's the president, and that's, you know, his critics on the left and the right. And that doesn't necessarily open the doors for reconciliation or for cooperation. It doesn't even have to be reconciliation. It can be sort of cooperation to move agenda items forward.
We leave it there. Lily, thanks a lot for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
Lily Gorin's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Her published books include Women and the White House and Mad Men in Politics. And she was with us today to talk about the growing divisions within the Republican Party and what it could mean for the future of the GOP.